Stuart Lee, one of the busiest, possibly most workaholic comics on the whole scene. I mean, even I was amazed by the stuff. I can just go through and just start here with a list of Stuart Lee's enviable and irritating achievements here. I mean, we're talking things such as we've got the BAFTA nominee for Best Light Entertainment here. You've got Sony Gold Awards for with Radio 4 on the Hour. Director credits as well. Jerry Springer, the opera. We have Olivier Awards. Is there any room in your house for anything?
Well, the Olivier Award, I mean, I found that just incomprehensible, because the chain of events that led to that was, I'd kind of given up comedy about 4 or 5 years ago, and this composer, Richard Thomas, said, "Do you want to help out on this Jerry Springer opera idea?"
Yeah.
And it was just a little tiny thing, and it grew and grew and grew, and in the end we got an Olivier for writing it, and at one point I was nominated for Olivier for directing it, and I ended up directing it by accident, because there was no money to pay anyone, and I kept trying to get out of it, and...
Yeah.
And I tried to talk quite a famous female director into doing it, and she actually ended up talking me into doing it, which was good. And then when we went to the National, some of them didn't really want me to do it there at the National Theatre, and one of the guys said, "How are you going to scale up this little fringe production for a bigger theatre?" And I said, "I'll cast fatter people so they can be seen from further away." And so I didn't really know what I was doing, and I ended up with an Olivier nomination for directing this thing, and I'm not trying to be modest, but I was really worried that I was going to win on the night, in case, because the other people were totally legitimate, you know, people that really had studied it and knew what they were doing. And it was such a relief when I didn't get it. I would have felt such a charlatan. So it was great.
Because I was want to ask you, and will now, how you got into directing. You hinted there that it was just by accident.
Do you remember the double act, the Mighty Boosh, Noel Fielding and Julian Barrett? Yeah, they got the BBC Three thing now. I mean, they kind of asked me to help sort of script edit a live show they were doing for the Edinburgh Fringe in about 99, and I kind of ended up directing that. But to me, directing was just saying to people, make sure you face the front and that everyone can hear what you're saying, right? It wasn't really about what's your motivation. It tends to be, can your face be seen from different parts of the theatre, and can you speak up? Also, I'm a bit deaf, so it's quite good. I'm quite hot on diction and intelligibility. Then again, I was script editing this thing for Simon Munnery for BBC Three, Attention Scum, in about a year later, and the director dropped out at the last minute, and they sort of went, because I'd worked on it as a theatre piece, this thing, I kind of ended up just filling in the gap. And I remember I went home and I read a book called Directing 101 over the weekend, which told you how to direct on camera. And I made all these little notes, and I did a little storyboard, like a little comic book of what I wanted. And I thought, I'll be all right. And the first day of filming was on this beach down in the south coast of England. And I walked down the jetty to where all the camera crew were, who, you know what they're like, they're kind of lads, so a bit suspicious of you. And I made this little speech about where I wanted the cameras to go and what shots we were going to do first. And I thought, yeah, I've got away with it. Then I stepped backwards and fell off the jetty about 4 foot down into the sand. And that was my first sort of thing. But, I mean, I think with all stuff like that is, if you just say, I don't know what I'm doing and I've never done this before, I mean, you know, there's so many things you learn in stand-up about narrative, controlling an audience, just how to run a room, and what people actually like, because you can tell more about an audience response as a stand-up than you ever will as a musician or an actor or a writer or a painter or whatever. And I think that you can bring all that to bear on so many other things. I stopped stand-up for 4 years. I guess that was the thing that...
Why did you stop?
Well, I stopped because a lot of things happened around 5 years ago. One of them was that it seemed like everything I was doing for radio or TV was getting cancelled or not picked up, and I felt that maybe something was just changing and that I was a relic, you know, or there wasn't any place for it. So that was kind of one thing. The other thing was I got in this rut where... I got really good at what I was doing in stand-up, and I could always get it to work, but I didn't really like what I was writing anymore, and I didn't like the audiences for laughing at it. So it was really odd kind of loop of self-loathing, you know. And also, I just felt like I started to feel increasingly kind of marginalised on the circuit, like it was a bit of a weird act, but also I was never really well known enough to play my own crowds, you know, so it just became... And I also had a really terrible live booker called Nick, who kept sending me to the wrong towns on the wrong days. And
that's going to demoralise
you. Yeah, I know, yeah, but I think he's quit now. But there's still a piece of graffiti about him that I wrote in utter despair in the backstage dressing room of the Stand. But so it was
I've seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's me, I wrote that.
Oh, did you write that?
Yeah,
that's particularly vicious.
Yeah, because that was... Well, he'd sent me there with... I was supposed to be on a little tour with Andy Zaltzman, who was who's a great young kind of...
Satirist,
you know,
brilliant.
About 5 years ago, and he was just starting out. Nowhere had been told that I'd got this support act, so we just turn up and no one was expecting Andy Zaltzman. So he ended up just having this kind of weird two-week holiday with me, where he had to find other things to do in the evening. And I'm visiting random cities in Scotland and the north of England. But I just ran out of ideas, really, and I didn't feel any sort of passion for it. And then I think coming back after 4 years, it's on the one hand, having worked on Jerry Springer the Opera, which just got bigger and bigger and bigger with more people, just being on your own suddenly seemed quite attractive. And also getting older, right, and kind of being... I've come back kind of 2 stone heavier, balding and grey. And I think that... whereas before, I was like a kind of young boy talking about stuff, and I think this, you can talk about more things when you just feel older, almost.
Oh, more,
you know,
experience, yeah, more, yeah, things happen in your life.
You know, if you have a gig and it doesn't work, you can come off and you can say, well, you know, this audience weren't my kind of crowd, or something went wrong, or the setting wasn't right. But you can't actually pretend that anything happened other than that you were standing on stage in relative silence, right? Whereas kind of with... With musicians, there's like all the noise of the amps going, or whatever. And with actors, there's a kind of seriousness about the vibe in a theatre that kind of protects them. And I think you're totally aware as a comedian of your own failure. And I think that to bring that fear to bear on other aspects of performance is really great.
I think you're right. I think there are things. You certainly can't be too earnest.
No.
You can't be pompous.
No.
In stand-up, because these things, you will just have your ankles cut off.
Yeah, and also you kind of know if you appear to lose your temper or show any kind of weakness, you lose an audience. And I think that a lot of other stuff's about kind of bluff. And I think you become a good liar. You get good at lying to people and bluffing them, and that's quite helpful.
I do photography. In fact, I've got a photographic memory, except mine is an amateur photographic memory. All of my memories are blurred and out of focus, cut off at the neck. A lot of them are sort of glamour and swimwear stuff. I can't actually remember anything about my life between the ages of 9 and 11 because I left a lens cap on my face.
To be a stand-up comic, you want to be dealing pretty much in... Here's how I feel about this.
Yeah.
Here's how I feel about that.
This. And
so how do you do that when you're getting a bit old and you're not sure? Anymore?
Well, that was sort of... That, again, was something about coming back after 4 years. Because when I was doing stand-up in the 90s, and in the double act as well, and actually Richard Herring, I used to do the double act with, even though, I mean, I did maybe 400 live shows with the double act and thousands on my own in the 90s, he very much helped me find out sort of who I was as a stand-up. Because we used to live together when we first moved to London, and I'd come in and go and tell him about something that had happened to me or something that I'd said. And it would be something that I was seriously annoyed about. And he would start laughing and saying, your worldview is just so ridiculous and extreme that if you said that on stage, people would think it was a kind of character, you know. And he kind of... So he sort of helped me kind of notice that. And in the double act, we were very much trapped in the relationship that we'd had as teenagers, you know, where he was the silly one and I was the cool one. You know, you always have that kind of partnership sort of thing. And I think... So, yeah, you were kind of trapped in these... in these quite absolute extreme positions. And then coming back to stand-up after 4 years off, I'm sort of wondering, can you really talk about things that you're confused about without having to take a point of view?
That's interesting you say that you felt kind of dislocated or not part of the scene.
Yeah.
And wondering whether the scene had changed.
Yeah. Well, I think it did up to a point. But
I think it does.
I think it's changing back now. I mean, that's the exciting thing about starting again is... The 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds that are out there, it seems to have split into two, the circuit. There's loads of people doing Jongleurs and the Comedy Store, which has kind of become a bit like the working men's club circuit 30 years ago. It's kind of, you know, you always know you're going to be what you're going to get and it's going to be fine. But then all these other, like, there's a lot of really peculiar young acts, and they remind me much more of the tail end of the sort of 80s circuit that I caught when I was starting, mm-hmm. you know, and with really peculiar, interesting acts who didn't really mind if it didn't work or not, yeah. you know, and I feel really much happier to be part of this now. I think BBC Two and Channel Four, when I was young, that was kind of my cultural education. I couldn't believe it. I lived in a suburb of Birmingham where you had no access to anything, and then you'd see like coverage of the Fringe, and you'd see people like you on it, and you'd see bits of music that you would never otherwise have come across. And that feels was, I think, in the '90s, for better or worse, there were a lot of people that were really good at stand up in a really professional way, who kind of wore suits and talked about relationships and dogs and cats, and it kind of was just sort of, well, I didn't even mean that to be rude, because it's a funny subject.
No, you're right.
But and I think it got marketable and slick, and I miss the sort of mess of it. What I want to find out with stand-up is it possible to kind of carry on with it at a sustainable level without having to be on lots of telly? There's a new thing which no one's found out yet, which is everyone seemed to be either becoming really well known and doing big tours and telly programmes, or they get on the sort of Jongleurs Comedy Store corporate work circuit, which pays a lot.
Okay.
And I just wondered, is there a way of not doing either of those, but carrying on? And John Hegley's managed to do that. Mm. And I talked to him about it, and he was saying, well, what you have to do is play nice little places that hold about 200 people, and they'll have you back every year, and that's a career. And he said, always have something to sell, like a book or a CD afterwards. Now, I tried that. I've got a load of remaindered copies of my novel from the... I bought them at cost price off the publisher, and I had some badges made. And the first two nights of the tour, I did try to sell stuff in Birmingham. But I made about 12 quid both nights, and I felt really embarrassed, like kind of tramp hanging around outside going, oh, can you get these badges off me?
Yeah.
Quid. But, you know, but anyway, Hegley kind of explained that it's kind of about building a relationship individually with workably sized venues rather than ending up in a publicly subsidised theatre that holds 1,000 people and playing to 80 people. Mm. You know, so that's kind of what I'm curious about, is it possible to do that? And kind of loads of the bands that I like have ended up in that position where they can just carry on. That's sort of what I'm trying to do with stand-up, really.
I've been trying to create false certainties in my life by organising everything I own into alphabetical order on this shelf. There's a B, Buddha, C, Coconut Chimp, H, hardback books there that I've read. And a lot of people have said to me that doing this kind of thing is the work of an obsessive and dysfunctional man. And these are the people that have said that. There they are. And these strings indicate the exact location of their homes.
You've worked with Simon Munnery, and for those who don't know, I mean, Simon's one of the most interesting people on the stand-up, cabaret, performance, art scenes.
Yeah.
And clubs are a thrustra.
Yeah.
Now, I recall, this is from about 1993.
Yeah.
And you were working on this. So, remind us about that. Was it in Brighton?
Clubs Zarathustra was like this thing that Simon Munnery used to do, this character of a... The character was called the League Against Tedium. It was one man with delusions of grandeur who used to kind of spout philosophy about how he was the best human being in the world. And he decided to set up this gig in a pub in North London, in a little cellar. It held about 80 people. And the idea was that any comedian, he'd compare it as this character, and comedians could do it, but you couldn't do your act. You had to do something that wasn't stand-up. And I remember, you know, Kevin Eldon used to do a thing every couple of weeks where he would just measure things in a room with a piece of tape. That was quite good. And
come on, see a game, man.
You know, so it was stuff like that. And somehow it kind of grew into an Edinburgh show, which we did in the Fringe for 3 or 4 years. And eventually we did a Channel 4 pilot of it in 1967, before we were born, 1997. I'm losing track of it. It feels so long ago. And yeah, we did a Channel 4 pilot of it. And we wanted a certain amount of money to make it, and they gave us about two-thirds of what we thought it would cost, because it was all, you know, we wanted an audience of identically dressed women that all looked the same, applauding everything, and we had a giant kind of robot that sang opera. It's kind of the start of a lot of the opera ideas, actually. And so instead of delivering the 23-minute pilot we were supposed to do, we arrogantly and conceitedly, in the naivety of youth, delivered a 19-minute pilot, of which the last 4 minutes were a blank screen with a phrase flashing saying, insert more money, and just recordings of us talking to each other about what we imagined the Channel 4 executives would think of it and going, what do you think they'll make of it, Kev? Well, I don't know, I think they'll think it's culty like Vic Reeves. They won't understand it, but they might go for it. So it was like that, and you know what? They were understandably irritated by that and said, we won't commission this unless you can deliver 6 scripts. And the kind of group of people involved in it was such a ragbag of freaks that we never really got it together. It was a shame because it was a wasted opportunity, and the live shows were really good.
You're listening to the League Against Tedium Pure Nonsense in stereo.
Thought. Judge a man by his shoes. Look at you in your clothes. Do you know what you look like? You look like something out of the 1990s. You look like you belong here. Trainers, what are you training for?
What are you going to do now after, I mean, your involvement with Jerry Springer? That's been for a few years now, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was a little fringe run in Battersea Arts Centre in South London. I thought it'd be one of these things that we'd done over the years there that last about 2 weeks. And then it kept... The two-week run would go well, and they'd go, do you want to do another one? And we'd write a bit more of it and do it again kind of 3 months later. And it just got bigger and longer. And then in the end, the National Theatre picked it up.
Mm.
And it ended up being 4 years, yeah. And it was really brilliant. It's the best thing I've ever been involved in. But it feels such an odd idea. It doesn't feel part of a career plan or like a race. Yeah, so I did this. Then I directed an opera about Jerry Springer, obviously, and then I did the next thing. It's sort of... And I think I worry about that for Rich, because it's sort of... He's a brilliant musician and composer, and it's sort of... There's no point trying to repeat that.
Mm.
You know, there's no point trying to do blah, blah, the opera or whatever. You have to, you know, but it was a weird one.
Well, I was going to say this is a difficult situation for you now, being involved with Jerry Springer, which has been such a phenomenon. You can't be categorised or pigeonholed as the Jerry Springer guy, because as we've said, your profile is somewhere just underneath the radar.
I mean, I didn't get any death threats about it. The BBC executives did. No one knew. Like, people didn't really know who we were or, you know, worry about it. So we were kind of out of it. I mean, I think the thing about that was I really enjoyed the process of developing it in the Fringe theatres, and I loved doing the Edinburgh Fringe run of it that we did, and I really liked it at the National. Mm. And by the time you get into the West End, right, of London, and when people are on 7 shows a week, you feel like an employer, and they're the kind of workers in the factory of musical theatre having to kind of knock it out every time. The overheads of running it in the West End are so high that you're paying £45 a ticket. No one I know... or no one in my family could afford to go and see it anyway. It was kind of so... I thought, how did I end up working on this thing where it's totally not for anyone that I know? Mm. You know, and that, so that was odd. And when it was shown on BBC Two, one of the things I was glad about was that it was free. You know, and it started off in little publicly funded places, and it ended up free on TV for 2 million people to see and 50,000 people to complain about.
Come and see.
On June the 17th last year, I was told that Sherry Blair was going to come and see it.
Mm.
And normally, if we were around, they would want us to, like... I mean, I had to go and have a half-hour drink one night with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Michael Douglas, which is just bizarre, you know, because they were in. And there were things like that were happening, where you'd end up meeting these people. So the idea was, the PR woman was saying, will you go and meet Sherry Blair after the show and thank her for coming? And I said, well, no, frankly, because You know, I'm one of 2 million people that marched against the war. I think that's going to totally unethical. It's going to come back and haunt us for decades. And I don't want to be like an A-list celebrity New Labour apologist by having to shake hands with Sherry Blair. And then this weird thing happened where she said, I understand how you feel, but her guest that's coming with her is the president of SCOPE, the Spastic Society, right? So perhaps you would like to meet them. And there's this odd thing where whether you choose to snub the Prime Minister's wife and then be rude to the woman from SCOPE as well. And I don't really... In the end, what I did was I said I would go and I just didn't turn up.
Oh.
And, that was a great... That was my powerful political gesture. But,
no, it wasn't powerful. You just walked over. You head under a table.
I walked away and
hid
under a table, yeah. Because it was... You know, it's things like that. And I think, yeah, you find it useful as a stand-up to have these positions of black or white, but then my life's becoming much greyer now. And, you know, having worked on something that was a success, it's harder to... Like, you know, the Evening Standard want to do a ticket deal, you know, subsidise it, basically. Mm. Cheaper tickets. That's good. It means people get in for a tenner rather than 45 quid.
Mm.
But it's the Evening Standard, which is the second most right-wing paper in the country.
Mm.
How do you feel about that? Their arts coverage is good. I don't know. It's sort of, you kind of end up, you know...
And what you're facing now is you're facing potential compromises. You're facing lots of seductions here, there and everywhere. And that may be precisely what happens to a performer who is offered, you know, a game show or whatever the hell it is.
Maybe well, there's a jazz musician called Billy Jenkins that I like, and he asked me a few years ago about trying to do a TV pilot with him, and he said, the thing is, he said, people have been congratulating me for 30 years for not selling out. I'm a lollipop man in South London, and I'd quite like to buy in. Right? And I thought that was a really, you know, a nice way of putting it. Absolutely love Joe Spring of the Opera, and it's because, you know, Richard Thomas is brilliant and the whole central conceit of it is just great, and I was really proud to be involved in it. But and I'd do something else with him if he ever wanted to, but so I mean it kind of added up to nothing. And also the weird thing was I made about £80,000 out of it over 4 years, because the first 2 years we were working free. The middle bit was we got paid by the National, and then the West End run we got paid on weeks when it broke even, and it didn't always cover its running costs. It feels like a kind of weird dream that never happened, almost, because there's kind of not much to show for it apart from the Olivier Award statuette. But and then I got offered lots of odd jobs after that. People kept talking to me about did I want to direct musicals and stuff, and I don't like them or know anything about them, so I kind of you know there was talk about something on Broadway, and I just thought I couldn't begin to do it. I'd hate it, you know.
This is like the manager of a successful football team saying, actually, no, I don't like football very much.
I just fell into it by accident.
I was selling boots. This happened.
Well, it feels a bit like that.
You've had a lot of success as a writer, a lot of success as a performer.
Yeah, no one really knows who I am, though. I'm able to walk around the street without being recognised, ever. What mainly happens to me is people think that I'm Edwin Collins or Ali Campbell from UB40. I tend to get mistaken for them, or a fat Terry Christian from The Word, or, you know, Mark Fowler from EastEnders. I tend to get mistaken for other people more than I... In fact, only last week, in Leicester, a bloke thought I was Ali Campbell from UB40 and asked me, why was I at the Leicester Comedy Festival? So it's sort of, you know, it's kind of, it is weird, like, limbo, where you look at it on paper and you go, oh, he's done well. But actually, nothing's really added up to anything. So it's, in a way, that's been a godsend, because you can carry on with a level of anonymity doing all different things, and no one's shouting catchphrases at me in the street. I mean, I worked with Johnny Vegas about 18 months ago on a live video, and we couldn't go anywhere without, it would take us half an hour to get across a room, because everyone's shouting, where's your monkey at him, and trying to, you know, so it's sort of a two-edged sword, isn't it?
So you're quite happy with that situation?
Yeah. I want to actually... I'm playing the Isle of Skye tomorrow night, and that's a deliberate effort to lower my profile.
Stuart Lee. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Thanks a lot for having us. It's nice to see you.